Welcome to the Gentleman Ultra podcast. Today I'm joined by a filmmaker who wrote and directed the brilliant documentary, The Phenomenon, Ronaldo, which offers a glimpse into the story of Ronaldo's redemption, his life as a superstar, you know, pushing him to the brink of retirement, you know, two new knees, World Cup glory, and I guess everything else in between. Duncan McMath, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Yeah. So, of course, you've written and directed this brilliant film or documentary. Do you call it a documentary or do you call it a film?
Depends who I'm talking to. If I want to sound, you know, a little bit flash, I might call it a film. But no, definitely, it's a feature documentary, I think, officially.
Yeah, feature documentary, and it's amazing, absolutely amazing. So, of course, based on the life of the Brazilian Ronaldo. Yeah. So obviously, the obvious question is, you know, why did you make the documentary? And how did it all come about?
It's been a long process, to be honest, because we started working with Ronaldo when he bought Real Valladolid. So he bought Real Valladolid in Spain, just outside Madrid, back in 2018. And we had the idea that it'd be amazing to do a sort of follow doc with a president rather than with a football club. So, and obviously being Ronaldo, we knew we'd have excuses to flash back to his career throughout that follow doc. So we approached Valladolid. They were super keen. Real Valladolid isn't a particularly exciting club, to be perfectly honest with you. It's much more exciting now that Ronaldo's there. But they're a club that's never really won very much, never really won anything, to be honest. They've kind of yo-yoed between the first division and the second division. Valladolid is one of those towns that it's a very pretty city, but you don't really go there unless you have to. No one's passing through Valladolid, and it's very, very cold for a lot. Being Spain, it's got a reputation for being very, very cold. And as soon as we started working with the club, everyone said, "Oh, careful, it's cold up there." But all right, yeah, thanks. Anyway, so we approached the club. They were really keen. Ronaldo wasn't quite so keen because he obviously had so much on his plate. He was like, "Oh, I don't know if I really want the cameras around now." And anyway, we had to convince him. And basically the way we did it was just to say, "Let us in. We'll film the first episode. We'll show you the first episode. If you like it, we'll carry on. If you don't, we won't. We won't speak to any platforms. It's like a complete risk that we're taking. We're investing in this idea." And luckily for us, I remember the day we showed it to him, we went up to, because he lives in Madrid, he's got a beautiful flat in Madrid right in the centre, and the Valladolid office is almost below his flat. So he kind of walks, it's less than a 2-minute walk to get to the Valladolid office, which is in Madrid.
That's convenient.
And we were
it?
All set. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we're all set up there, ready to show him episode one of a series called El Presidente. And he came in. What I loved about him, because I've shown films, documentaries and episodes to a lot of people. And he walked in, he took his mobile phone, he turned it off and he put it face down on the table, pushed it away from him, sat back, put his glasses on, and for 40 minutes watched episode one of El Presidente. It finished and he just turned to me, went, "Brilliant, congratulations," and walked out. And that was it. And we were like, "I guess that means we can continue." And the guy's like, "Yeah." So after that, we ended up filming with him. And we went to the States. We went to Mexico. We went to the Philippines. We went to Ibiza, his house in Ibiza. And he invited all when Valladolid stayed up. It was like the penultimate weekend that they managed to stay up. And he invited the whole team to Ibiza, to his villa for a weekend, fully paid for by Ronaldo. And we were sent a message by the CEO of the club saying, "Do you want to come along and film it?" I was like, "Let me think about that." "Yeah, all right, all right."
Yes.
And we all stayed in the Hard Rock Hotel. I mean, it was absolutely magic, absolutely magic. So then off the back of that series, we sold that to DAZN, and it went out on the DAZN platform. It was very well received. Ronaldo was obviously very, very happy with it. The club were very happy with it. And off the back of that, we went back to Ronaldo and said, "Right, we've done this. We've gained your trust. You see how we work. How about doing the documentary about your life?" And luckily he said yes. He's one of those guys, I think, and I see this with the team that's around him, of like such a good bunch of guys and girls, all around him. And they're people that have been working with him for years and years. I think once you're in with Ronaldo, you're in. He's got quite a small circle that he trusts, but they've been with him for a long time. And I think in a way, obviously we're not as close to him as they are, but in a way it was the same for us. We proved ourselves. We showed that he could trust us. He liked what we did and we were in.
Mm, yeah. How surreal is that to be sitting there next to the original, you know, and the best Ronaldo, as far as I'm concerned. But
original and the best.
Know, yeah. But even, you know, sitting in a house in Ibiza, having a party. Yeah. Was there a few like sort of pinch me moments?
Oh man. Yeah. There were a lot of pinch me moments. I mean, the Ibiza trip was the big one. Because he basically put on a private jet for us to all fly over from Madrid to Ibiza. So just the start, I've never been on a private jet before in my life, obviously. And we're walking like we didn't even have to go through security. We're just like straight onto the tarmac and just getting out of the car and walking onto a plane. It was like, what's this?
I hope there was a montage, a musical montage linked to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, too right there is.
Yeah.
And then another great thing was getting to his house in Ibiza, and he took us on a little tour of his house, and he's got a football pitch. He's got obviously a beautiful infinity swimming pool where you can literally see the sea from the pool. He's got two tennis courts. And then we walked down to the football pitch and he was like, come this way. And it was like this kind of bunker, a door into this bunker. We're like 100 meters from the house. Mm-hmm. And he opens it up and there's just a nightclub underneath the house next to the football pitch with a proper DJ set up. It's unreal. Just like, oh man, yeah. That's could crazy. Stay here for a few weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. So for someone who's had like a, you know, obviously you're involved in Take the Ball and Pass the Ball prior to that, the documentary, and that was on the Spanish national team. Yep. And then obviously like
That was on Barca.
On Barca.
It was on Barca. Sorry. It was Pep Guardiola's 4 years at Barca. Yeah.
Yep. So with this one, with Ronaldo, you've got like so much to tell, and his career is just like incredible. Like, where did you start? What was the decision to start behind, like, you know, the prior to the kickoff to the final? Was that like sort of, you know, the tipping point and the tip of the iceberg, I guess?
I think when you're looking at a documentary about someone's life, it's very important to pick a key moment of that player's life or that person's life, rather than trying to tell the entire story. And I think, you know, a big influence for me with all the films I've made is Asif Kapadia, who did the Maradona film, who did Senna. And if you look at any of his films, it's very much centered on, obviously, Maradona is Napoli.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of the Argentine national team and Argentina national team, but it's very much Napoli. And for us, it was like, right, we've got to find our Napoli moment, if you like. We've got to find that moment where a whole 90-minute feature documentary, a film, can be based on that time period. Mm. And not Ronaldo was a very talented youngster who ended up signing for Cruzeiro, and then he went to... I didn't want to tell that whole story.
Yeah.
And it didn't take particularly long, to be honest. Obviously, I knew his career very well anyway, having lived and worked in Spain for the last 20 years. I also... had just worked on a 6-part series El Presidente, which we were just talking about. And it was like, this time for me, it was very obvious that we were talking before about whether it's a documentary or a film. I think his story from 1998 to 2002 is like a film script. And I've said it time and time again. It's like a screenplay. Like, honestly, if you took that to Hollywood and said, you know, there's a player, he's the best in the world, and then he picks up these horrible injuries and has a fit before the World Cup final, and then practically doesn't play for 4 years and just scrapes back into the Brazil team and ends up winning the World Cup in 2002. They'd be like, oh yeah, nice one. Where'd you invent that? You know, where did that? It's just incredible that it's real life. It really is. And when we started looking into it and looking into the archive, and It was just so exciting to work on. I can't tell you. And that was my kind of main challenge, just to transport you as a viewer back to that time period. And even though a lot of us know what happened, some people will be watching it without knowing a lot of the details, but most people being football fans would have known what happened. I think there's a lot of details that either you've forgotten or that you didn't know. And, And the idea was to really make you relive those 4 years.
Yeah. And of course, like, you know, the Maradona documentary starts with, it's almost essentially like a car chase through the streets of Naples to like his unveiling. And it's, that almost gets you on edge. It's and this starts out similarly. So like before that final against France, and like, I know what happens and you've read about it and you've seen stuff, you know, like prior to kickoff here in Australia, but I've never seen that level of detail or, you know, like the clips of, you know, the news guys being handed, you know, the team sheet or being, you know, like all that sort of confusion, like all of that sort of stuff. And that was so good to watch. And it just built the tension up like so well, so well. So yeah, it's a bang on job there. Yeah. But speaking Thank of real you. Life, yeah, so how did you end up in Spain, like where you are now and working over there involved with, I'm guessing, Spanish football?
Yeah. I was always keen to learn Spanish because I tried at school and had a teacher I hated and I did really badly because of it. And I always felt like, oh man, I've let her win.
Spite's a good motivator.
I know. Yeah, totally. It was totally spite. I was like, I'm going to show her. I mean, she was a French teacher teaching Spanish. I don't even think she spoke Spanish, if I'm honest. But she taught us at school anyway. I don't know about Australia, but in England, languages aren't taken particularly seriously. But I was always desperate to learn Spanish. And I thought after university, I'd come out here. I did an intensive Spanish course in Seville, which unbeknownst to me is like the Newcastle or the Scotland of Great Britain or England, because they've got such a strong accent that even the Spanish can't understand what they're saying down in Seville. So I went to the hardest place to learn Spanish, thought I'd be fluent after about 4 months and could barely order a coffee. So then I had the opportunity to do a master's degree in Madrid, which was luckily taught in English. And I did that master's degree, obviously met Spanish friends and spoke more and more Spanish. Got offered an internship at Real Madrid TV because they've got an English version of the TV channel. And I worked on that internship for about 6 months. And then they offered me a full-time job. And I was at Real Madrid TV for 3 years. By the end of that stint, I'd learned Spanish, luckily. And then I moved to Barcelona to work for a Spanish TV sports channel, commentating and presenting Premier League footage, Premier League programs, games. So yeah, that was my journey. And then after that, I did more and more off-camera stuff. I realized that I much preferred scripting and putting together reports and mini documentaries. And I slowly moved more into documentaries and then eventually into feature length. And the film you spoke about earlier, Take the Ball, Passable, which is based on a book by the author and journalist Graham Hunter, The Making of the Greatest Team in the World. Mm-hmm. It's all about Pep Guardiola's 4 years at Barca. Mm-hmm. And I read his book on my honeymoon. Oh, it's down there
somewhere. Yeah.
It's a brilliant book. I read it on my honeymoon.
It is
a great
book. Excellent.
Called Graham up and I said, I think we've got to make a documentary about this. And he was fully behind it. So we did it. Yeah. And that was the start.
Yeah. Did you by chance cover the iconic two-legged semi-final against Inter Milan in that documentary?
Yeah, of course.
You can't, of course. That's got some drama in itself, doesn't it? Just those two matches. They're amazing, amazing games. Man. Everything on the field, off the field. You couldn't have scripted that any better.
No, exactly. It was the volcano, wasn't it?
Yeah, the volcanic ash, I think it was. All the planes got cancelled.
Barca ended up having to go down on the coach, and yes. But the big thing for us, like every film needs a bad guy. And with Ronaldo, we had Hector Cooper, which I'm sure we'll talk about later on. And we also had his knee from the very start. We were like, his knee has got to be like the baddie. You've got to kind of see it coming and really hate it and just think, crikey, if it wasn't for that damn knee, you know, what would have happened? And with Take the Ball, Passable, we had Jose Mourinho, which was, I mean, you don't get a better baddie.
Yes.
So that was fantastic.
It just writes itself. Yeah. So when obviously you're aware of his career and you're aware of what Ronaldo had accomplished, but some of the stuff like the early days, the footage from Brazil and even a lot of the footage from like PSV, it's almost like he's a a different player. Like, did some of that footage surprise you to try and like remember just how good he was?
Ah, totally, totally. And you know what it was like in the 90s? You know, it's not like now. You couldn't just kind of flick a couple of channels and be watching Ronaldo playing for PSV. You know, you either saw him playing for Brazil at World Cups or World Cup qualifiers, or you saw highlights, basically. And you're lucky to see if he scored an absolute screamer. Maybe it would come up on some show. I really saw very little of Ronaldo before he was at Barca. And even at Barca, it wasn't like I was watching live matches. Like, it would be very much highlights. But so for me, looking back at especially some of those Cruzeiro goals, there's a goal he scores for Cruzeiro just before he leaves, and it's in the film, and it's absolutely astonishing.
I talked to Leonardo Bertozzi, who's a Brazilian commentator, follows Italian football closely, and he was there at that game, and he still says that's one of the greatest goals he's ever seen, you know, in person. And says amazing.
It was really difficult to find that goal, and we didn't manage to find it in high quality. But even though it's really grainy, I mean, it's exceptional, absolutely exceptional. Mm-hmm. And like you say, like that, I mean, there's so many. He was, before his injury, he seemed to be a striker that, you know, he'd pick up the ball on the halfway line, take on five players and score. And it was like copy paste almost every game he played.
And almost it, like, now what differentiates him from everybody was, like you said, you know, like it was an unknown, you know, if you weren't necessarily following the Dutch league, you would know that they've signed this, you know, Brazilian wonder kid who's come over, and he was taking people by surprise. You know, nowadays, a lot of the teams, you can just swap shirts and everyone plays the same. They've all got their own style. He was so unique, but just his power and his speed and everything, like, it's just, incredible. Do you think if he wasn't born in Brazil, he would have been a completely different player?
I don't know. I don't think he's, in some ways, he's quite a European player, I think. He's not, I mean, he's extremely skillful, and you see some of those flicks and turns, which are very Brazil influenced, obviously. And in fact, even the kind of toe poke finishes are very football Salah. You know, that's not so European, because he often talks about Romario, and Romario obviously, you know, finished like that all the time, just toe punting the ball.
Yeah. Telly Bludgers. Call him Telly Bludgers in Australia.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Nice. Telly Bludgers.
Telly Bludgers. Yeah.
It almost felt like playing at school, it felt like you were cheating if you toe punt. I mean, the kids that were no good at football would toe punt it.
Yeah.
It was almost like forbidden.
Yeah, when I was a goalie, I was a goalie taking goal kicks, I'd always just toe it. Yeah, just toe it. Did you want to just kick it as long as you can? It. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But he does it, and it just looks awesome. But back to your point about would he have been the same player, I think maybe not with the flicks and tricks that he had, but I think, you know, he is a footballer that he did things better than any other number nine I've ever seen. But in many ways, it was quite simple. He would just be quicker, faster, stronger than the defense. You saw those goals for Barca where there's two defenders and it's against Valencia. He literally grabs them. It's Sid Lowe described it like a metro train. It's like he's arriving late for a metro train. He just grabs the doors and opens them and he's through. And it's like that. I mean, that's not Brazilian. That's just sheer brute force and strength and taking it round the goalkeeper. He's just clever and quicker, more cleverer, quicker and faster and stronger, I think.
Yeah. And his ability to take people on, like, you know, even one-on-one and even from a distance, like you mentioned there, it's just, even like you watch it nowadays and, you know, if you haven't gone back and watched his goals or, you know, his highlights and stuff for a long time, you sort of forget in a way, you know, it just sort of gets overlooked, I guess. But yeah, it's incredible. Yeah, there's that one scene too in the documentary, and I think it's sort of towards the start, where he's in like a supermarket. He's in a supermarket and he's just being absolutely mobbed. And it's so eerily similar to watching Maradona in Naples. And he's just getting pulled from pillar to post and his shirt, and he's, you know, he's got the smile on his face and he looks like he's okay with it. But then it just starts to get a bit out of control and you're just like, you got to get me out of here. You know, it's quite scary.
Yeah. And then they can't even, can't even move the car. Yeah, you're right. That was intense. And the idea was to make you feel uncomfortable when you watched it, because that's certainly the feeling I had when I watched it the first time. And like you say, he's got that kind of smile on his face, but you know it's a fake smile because you can see the fear in his eyes. And he's actually just coming out of the airport. And it's just, I've never seen anything like it. Having said that, because we've now kind of been working with him and filming with him since 2018, I've never seen a scene like that, but it is incredible. You started before we started recording, you said everyone loves Ronaldo, and it is incredible. I mean, I completely agree with you. And it's incredible how much pull he still has, considering he retired however many years ago. You know, we'll be out in the street with him, and you can guarantee that in 5 minutes he's surrounded by 20 people.
Yeah.
I've just never been near someone who's so famous, so much time after he retired. He's just still an icon.
And I think too, it helps because he hasn't gotten into, you know, I guess like TV punditry, or he hasn't gotten into management or coaching. It's almost like the less you see of him, like, you know, like less is more. And so then if you do see him, it's almost like, you know, a unicorn spotting you. Oh my God, it's him. He's real. He exists, you know? So
true.
He can't not help but get excited. Yeah. Yeah. How was his, like you mentioned it there too, and you touch on it in the documentary, like his relationship with Romario. It's quite unique, isn't it? Because they're two very different individuals.
Yeah. They're very different. I think that they're close. I don't think they're super close. It's a weird one because Romario was such a role model for Ronaldo, and the reason that he went to PSV and also he talks about how he used to watch him, especially in the 1994 World Cup where Ronaldo didn't play at all. He would watch Romario, not just playing, but training. He would really watch him, and he learned a lot from him. And Romario jokes that in 1994, all Ronaldo did at the World Cup was clean his boots and make him coffee. But then in 1998, Romario picks up that injury, doesn't go to the World Cup. So they never actually get to play together in 1998. And then by 2002, they're actually rivals for a position in the national team. So it's kind of gone from a friendship, Romario very much Ronaldo's role model, to then a rivalry. It's definitely a relationship that's got a lot of elements, a lot of ingredients. It's interesting.
Yeah. That press conference with, is it Scolari when he announces the squad for 2002?
Yeah.
Like, exactly. Yeah. It's just like, it's almost like silence before every name. He's just waiting to announce. Yeah. And like, again, like build up to that squad. It's incredible how he announces it.
I was so excited about that scene. That was definitely one of the moments, like you were saying before 1998, the final, obviously that was a key moment in our narrative. But also the Willy won't he be called up by Scolari, who the Brazilians call Filipão.
Yeah.
Felipe Scolari, Filipão. Willy won't he be called up, and the fact that Filipão leaves Ronaldo's name till the last, there's that dramatic pause before he announces it. It's just, yeah. I mean, it couldn't have been scripted better.
Yeah, I know. I found myself giving fist pumps, even though, like, I knew he was going to be picked, but I'm like, good on him. God, that's fantastic. Yeah. That's very cool. Very cool. Yeah. So had you, like, obviously you watched football, you know, you'd seen World Cups as a kid, or you'd seen, you know, had you taken interest in sport as a kid and as a youngster, or did you just sort of stumble into it by chance? Because obviously, you know, obviously you didn't plan on ending up in Real Madrid TV and then a Barcelona TV station, et cetera, et cetera.
No, but it was always my idea. If I could have been a footballer, I'd have been a footballer without a shadow of a doubt. So I think so many journalists, we're failed footballers, aren't we? If we're perfectly honest, like I'd love to have had a career as a footballer. Having said that, now I know more about what it means to be a footballer. There's certainly some dark areas of that profession that people aren't necessarily aware of or don't fully contend with, but I think for me it was always the route I wanted to go. I wanted to be as close to football as I possibly could, and that meant becoming a journalist. And I quickly realized that actually I'd rather make documentaries than kind of following the day-to-day and writing about it.
Yeah, and like sharing the stories, like even this story, like in itself, like with Ronaldo, it's awesome how it highlighted, I thought, it was really cool how it highlighted like the mental side to the game and the battle like with mental health that you put across in the film. It's such a struggle for him and to come back from what he did come back from, when anyone could have just turned around and said, you know what, I've already won a World Cup, even if I didn't play. I've done, you know, X, Y, and Z. I've earned enough money. I'll pull up stumps. Yeah. How much do you reckon it took a toll on him to get, you know, from between France 98 and 2002, you know, mental health wise?
Huge. It was a really big issue. And he talks about it really honestly in the documentary. And I'd obviously had chats with him before we started filming. And I was very clear that what happened in 1998, which was this fit that he had, that he still doesn't know exactly what caused it. The fit before the final, literally a matter of hours before the final, it was very clear that it was down to pressure. I think, you know, that's what he believes, and the way he talked about it, I don't think there's any doubt. Even the doctors, agree and said the same. And if you look back, and as soon as we started looking back, and you mentioned that scene when he comes out of the airport and he's mobbed by how many hundreds of fans, I don't know, but hundreds. And then you look at kind of the press coverage before that 1998 World Cup, not just in Brazil. Obviously in Brazil, it was all about Ronaldo, but all over the world, it was all about Ronaldo. There's that airport commercial for Nike,
where
Ronaldo's the main man. He was the best player in the world. He just won the Ballon d'Or. He was still only 21, and so much is being expected of him, not just from Brazil, which is enough pressure as it is, but from the world. Like, this spectacle isn't going to be the same unless Ronaldo performs. And everyone, you know, we all want our national team to win, but we're all there to see, you know, the Messis or the Cristiano Ronaldos or the Ronaldos or Ronaldinhos or the Rivaldos or whatever it is. And in 1998, everyone was there to see Ronaldo.
Yeah.
And the pressure was immense.
Yeah, and that ad changed everything because it put so much pressure on them, you know, and they became like everyone's team and everyone's favorite sort of second team. If your country wasn't involved, then it was, you know, pick Brazil because they play this sort of style, and it just added to, I guess, another layer of pressure and expectation for them to do well that World Cup.
A bit like Leo Messi's Argentina in this last World Cup, and you think of the pressure. I mean, everyone wanted Argentina to win because it was Leo Messi's last chance to win a World Cup and to really proclaim himself as the greatest player of all time, potentially. And the pressure, I mean, just, you know, chapeau to him, because the pressure on him at that World Cup, luckily, no one else was good enough to beat them.
Yeah.
But, I mean, immense. And the same for Ronaldo in 98.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, like, Ronaldo makes the move across to Italy and joined Inter Milan. Yeah. How was that working, you know, I guess, following him across to Italy for the documentary and sort of involving yourself in Italian football? Yeah, how did you find that experience?
Yeah, it's great. Working with, I mean, Spain isn't that much better, but because this film is so heavily based on archive, getting the archive from the TV stations in Italy was not easy, because you have to,
That's really surprising, because normally they're so open to foreigners and welcoming, you know.
Well, you imagine, for this film, we had to work with, for our archive, we worked with Brazil, Italy, and Spain. It was a total nightmare, a challenge.
And you started making the film in 2003, was it?
Yeah, exactly.
Just about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, it was good. And it was great to look back at those years as well, because in the UK, there was a football show, which I'm sure you'll have heard about, presented by James Richardson, Football Italia, which was great and iconic at the time in the 90s. And that was a way that, for example, there was a lot of Serie A fans in England, because that was the way to watch European football. You couldn't, you couldn't watch La Liga before Sky took the rights.
It was free to air too, essentially, wasn't it? Like, the Premier League was behind its paywall or pay TV, and it was still on free. Yeah.
Correct. It was on Channel 4. So that was great and iconic and a lot of fun. And obviously, in that kind of time period, Gazza joins Lazio as well. So that, like, when David Beckham went to Real Madrid for UK viewers, suddenly there's a lot more attention on, firstly, Serie A, and then on La Liga. But The interesting thing is why he goes to Serie A, and there's so much controversy about that move and so many different theories. And it's something that it could have been a whole nother film, to be honest. There wasn't enough time to go into it in the documentary, but I mean, very, very interesting.
Yeah. And he adapted so well. Like his first season, he was footballer of the year, you know, 20 plus goals. He was scoring free kicks and penalties. And, you know, he won the Ballon d'Or, as you mentioned there.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, Moratti loved him.
Moratti was like his dad, wasn't he? He was
kind
of father-son relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, he had like, I know those knee injuries that he had at Inter Milan, they almost like took away that explosive power he had and that speed. Oh, that's how I sort of viewed it.
I agree with you 100%. I think, you know, one of the amazing things about Ronaldo is that he managed to reinvent himself.
Yep.
And he was, you know, he was the best number nine in the world because of his pace and because of his strength and because he'd take the ball around the goalkeeper. And then suddenly after his knee operations, he's a different striker, but he's still probably the best number nine in the world at that time. It's it's amazing that he could essentially be two different players and still be the best.
Yep.
But if you look at Barca, he scored 47 goals in 51 games. And then in his whole time in Italy, he scores 59 goals in 99 games. I mean, the difference is enormous. And there's a lot of people, especially in Spain, that do say if he hadn't have gone to Italy, would he have had the same injury problems? Would he have had a very, very different career? Would he have stayed at Barca potentially for his entire career and scored literally, you know, thousands of goals? But it's one of those things you'll never know. But he certainly says, and you'll have heard it in the documentary, he certainly says that going to Italy at the time, of course, at that time, Serie A is the league to play in. So there's no question that he wanted to be there for reasons of prestige and whatever else. And because as the best player in the world, he had to play in the best league in the world. Mm. But it was a much more physical league than he'd been used to, far more physical than Brazil, far more physical than Spain, and more physical as well than Holland.
Mm.
So he does get there and he has to train. He even says because it's a much more physical league, training sessions are much more physical. So you have to be fitter, you have to be stronger. And he would like to have trained separately to the rest of his teammates because he felt he had to train on very specific things, which was essentially goal scoring and short, sharp sprinting.
Yep.
And when he got to Italy and he was made to do 8-10 kilometers running in training, he says, there's a line in the film where he says, I knew it was going to do me damage and I was proved right. Mm. It's like, wow.
Yeah. Yep. And it's either, you know, I guess he missed 2001, I think it was. And then, you know, seasons either side of it. But yeah, when it happens again and his knee sort of, I guess it explodes almost like, even like in the documentary, like I almost like started crying. I was like devastated. You just can't not feel bad for him. But in Italy, he made some really good connections, you know, like in one of them was like Christian Vieri, who you have in the documentary, and their relationship and their partnership is like incredible. It's as if they've played together for years. Yeah. What was that like to sort of cover that little period in his life and that partnership?
Similar to the partnership with Romario, in that it was too short, and you think what they could have done together. I think Romario and Ronaldo never lost a game playing together, which is amazing, but they never played a World Cup together. And the same with Vieri, and Vieri himself says it's like, what could have been? He said, if we'd have both stayed fit, because Vieri had his own injury problems, which is a whole other story. But if we'd have both stayed fit throughout that period, we'd have won everything, he says. Mm. And I'm sure he's right, because it's, they got on so well on and off the pitch. They really loved each other. They really love each other. It's so, the same happened with Zinedine Zidane, with Diego Simeone. It's so nice to hear people talk about Ronaldo, because as you said earlier, everyone loves Ronaldo, but it really is true. And it's not just fans and journalists and people that have met him. It's his teammates, and it's like they love him so much. He's such a great person to have in the dressing room, such a great person to have around. Mm. He's such a lovely fella.
Yeah, it comes across like in the documentary, like you can genuinely tell But the teammates, yeah, they're just like in, they're all like they're in awe of him, aren't they? You know,
completely. Yeah, they're in awe of him. But I think like he's so funny and he's so friendly and he's, you know, it's when we interviewed Zidane, he started the interview by saying he looked straight down the barrel of the camera and he said, "Ronaldo, I'm only doing this because of you. Te quiero, I love you." Like this, and we were like, "Wow." It's a nice start.
Yeah.
So it was, to be honest, like people like that, you know, they just, Zidane doesn't do interviews, but because it was for Ronaldo, he did it.
Yeah.
And the Vieri connection's incredible. They were such close friends in Milan. They've remained close friends. And yeah, it was great to talk to him. He's also brilliant in the documentary, isn't he? He comes across so well. He's really funny. Swears a lot in the documentary, which I love because it just gives it that authenticity that you're really sat down with someone who's thinking back to that time.
Yeah. And of course, like, you know, we've got that little twang to his accent too. You know, if you're not expecting that he's going to speak English as, you know, as well as he does, which is very cool. Yeah. It's awesome. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. And what influence do you think, like, that time he had with Bobby Robson in Barcelona? Because they sort of really hit it off too as well, didn't they?
I think it's interesting because I've spoken to a lot of former Barca players who played under Johan Cruyff and then later under Bobby Robson. And the difference was just immense. Johan Cruyff was extremely strict and very, very tactical and would have a very clear vision of how his team would play, which is obviously the kind of Barca DNA, the 4-3-3, the possession-based football. And then Bobby Robson comes in and it's just like, yeah, no, just go and do your thing. And I think he really gave Ronaldo a lot of freedom, which obviously as a striker he'd have absolutely loved.
Yeah, it's very cool. In terms of like positive influence, I mean, like I know Romelu Lukaku's talked about Ronaldo. Benzema has Sergio Aguero. All those people, they've all
Zlatan
loves him. Yeah, like you know Ronaldinho as well. Like it's. Like his influence on that sort of generation, it's incredible. Yeah, what was it like to show him the documentary at the very end? Did he sit down and watch it with him the whole thing from start to end?
This is a very cool story that I'll never forget because he hadn't seen anything. He hadn't seen anything, and he didn't want to until it was done. So we're about at this stage, it's probably summer 2022. So we had a very strict broadcast date, which was September 2022 before the World Cup. He was in London. I was in contact with his agent every week, and he was in London filming the Nike ads that they did for the last World Cup. And he knew that he'd have a lot of downtime because I think that Nike had him there for like 7 or 8 days and he was only filming in the mornings. So he had 7 or 8 days in London with his afternoons free. So his agent said to me, the perfect scenario would be that, you know, you come over with a film, we go to a cinema and we hire out a cinema and we put on. Fine, perfect. So we went over and the film was funded by DAZN. It's on their platform in certain territories. They then sold it to other platforms like the BBC in the UK and Globo in Brazil. So the bosses from DAZN are there who put a lot of money into this film. Ronaldo's there with his agents. And we take the film over to show him. And he comes along with his girlfriend, his agent's wife as well, a couple of his mates. And we're sat in this private screening room. And I'm proper nervous. And he arrived about 40, he came from, we literally, we booked this screening room that was about 5 minute walk from his hotel, but he had to be driven for some reason. And the traffic was terrible. It took him about 45 minutes to get there. It would have been a 5 minute walk. So we're all kind of sat there nervous waiting for him. And his agent sending me like a screen grab of the Google Maps. And it was like, man, it'd be just quicker to get out and walk. But anyway, so they turned up about 45 minutes late. And he turned up and he was like, how are you? I was like, yeah, I'm really nervous. He said, so am I. I was like, oh my God, it's even worse. So we took him down to the screening room sat him and his girlfriend right in the middle. Everyone else is sat around. I'm sat right at the back so I can watch people watching it. Which sounds a bit creepy, but it's really important to see their reactions, because it's not often it's not often you're seeing people watch it for the first time, because all the guys at Zoom Sport, we've watched it so many times that it's difficult to react. So lights go down, film comes on, it's 94 minutes long. He laughed at all the right bits. It looked like he was getting emotional a couple of times. Anyway, we left and we all walked out of the screening room, and he grabs me, gives me a massive hug, and he says, "I can't even talk. I can't even tell you how great it was, because I can't even talk. I cried three times." And then I could see tears rolling down his eye, down his face as he's telling me this. I was like, bloody hell, I'm never going to get a better reaction to this film ever. It's just like, remember this moment.
Yeah, that's amazing. Awesome.
But the great thing is that all the DAZN execs are stood around at this time as well. So he says it in front of everyone. It was just, it couldn't have been a better reaction. And, you know, so grateful that,
that's cool.
That he did it and that he said it. Yeah, it was lovely.
I don't feel so bad sitting on my lounge crying in, you know, Australia, millions of miles away from everyone now. So that's good, yeah. That's really cool. Yeah. Did you ever, it's a really strange question, but did you ever find yourself gazing at other, you know, his knees and just going, holy geez, you know, like they're the knees.
The knees.
Yeah.
No, I have done a lot, because especially when we're filming with him for El Presidente, because he always wears shorts. He's like a Brit abroad. He's always in shorts. So you could see the massive
got
scars
sandals?
On his
knee. As long as he's got matching sandals, he's all good.
Yeah, he would wear socks with them, though.
Yeah, that's not right. Yeah.
He's too cool for that. But, the scars on his knees are, you know, are kind of amazing. Mm. They're very impactful when you see them.
Mm. Yeah. And is it, I guess, like, because obviously, you know, it's premiered and it's been shown everywhere and you would have seen it, but... do you feel like you sort of, I guess you don't really miss out, but you know, a lot of the people are watching it in their own homes, so you don't see that reaction. You don't get the, you know, the tears or the emotion, everything that comes afterwards and during the film. Yeah. How was it like the response and the reaction afterwards? Like, did you just, was it released and then you just turn your phone off and, you know, go into hiding for a little while, or were you sort of waiting nervously for, you know, for your phone and laptop and emails to start pouring in? Yeah. What was that like those next few days after it was out?
It's a funny thing. And I'm sure it's the same for a lot of us that work in this kind of industry. For you, when a podcast comes out or when an article you've written that you're very proud of comes out, it's like with a film, it's kind of that feeling, but times however many, because obviously we were 2.5 years in the making for this film. So you're building up over 2.5 years, and the same happened with Take the Ball Possible. The same happens with El Presidente. And it's like, there's this big premiere. Everyone's talking about it for a week. And then suddenly that's it. Everyone's moved on to the next thing. And it's like, what? And I have to say, it was that week was fantastic, because we had a brilliant premiere in Madrid, which obviously Ronaldo came to, and there were hundreds of fans outside the cinema waiting just for Ronaldo to come out and wave and sign some autographs. That was really cool. That was a great night. And then the reaction on social media, and obviously, you know, we don't want to give social media too much importance, but of course you're checking it. Of course you're reading reviews. And that was really nice. And no one, I really honestly haven't read a negative comment on social media. Everything's positive. The only kind of negativity is, I wish they'd have spoken more about Barca or more about Madrid or more about into whichever, you know, fan base is talking. But I think the film's gone down really well. But like I said, it's just that it's like everyone's talking about it for a week, or at least it feels like that. And then suddenly it's gone. And everyone's moved on, and it's time for you to move on. And it's like, oh, I don't know if I've enjoyed it enough to move on yet. What's next?
Yeah. What's next? Yeah, yeah. Well, exactly. Is it weird watching a film like in a premiere, I guess? Because like you mentioned, like you've worked on it. So you've seen it, and you've seen all the edits, and you've seen it all put together. Does it ever become like a bit blasé? Like, I know what's going to happen here. This is going to happen. That's going to happen. Or is it always still like a thrill every time you watch it, or every time you watch a highlight or a
I
little,
think
a couple of minutes of it?
yeah, I haven't watched it for a couple of months now. Obviously, leading up to broadcast, I mean, I probably watched, I maybe even watched it 1,000 times, like hundreds and hundreds of times, and every time you see something. And I think rather than I could watch it now and be totally entertained by it, because I think not because of what I did, but what Ronaldo does, the story is so strong. I do think it's well put together, and I'm very proud of it. But the story itself tells itself. You know, it's such a strong story, and the archive's just brilliant. And the interviews we got were brilliant. You know, Vieri, Zidane, Simeone, like this, the kind of the cast of interviews around Ronaldo really is superb as well. So it's a film that I think is very enjoyable, but I cannot watch it. And I guarantee if I watched it now, I cannot watch it without thinking, oh, that should be shorter. Oh, we should have cut that. Oh, that maybe there's a need. We need a bit of breathing space. I was watching it in Madrid, and I had this horrible panic that there wasn't enough breathing space around certain scenes. And I was like, well, it's too late to change it now. But I think it's impossible. And I don't know if you're like this when you're rereading an article that's already been published, but I think it's impossible not to go, oh man, maybe I could have tweaked that. Maybe I could have improved that. Yeah, but otherwise, you know, it'd be eternal, the process. You'd never finish.
And did you obviously, we talked about that goal earlier from Cruzeiro, but did you have a favorite goal, like the goal against Lazio in the UEFA Cup final? Was it's an
Brilliant.
iconic one, but yeah, to see
Yeah.
him do that on that pitch, in that on that setting, yeah, like it's amazing. Yeah, but did you have a favorite goal or a favorite moment, or was there something, on or off camera
It's
that
interesting.
you took away with you that you sort of kept on and kept on will keep forever?
It's interesting that you asked that, because I asked everyone I interviewed, I asked that question, and I've never actually thought about an answer myself. I always hoped that people wouldn't give me the same answer that other people had given me. I remember Tim Vickery telling me that classic Tim Vickery. He's a football journalist. You know him. You've interviewed him for this podcast, and he's
He's a
just he
legend.
always he's fantastic, and he's so articulate, and he's brilliant, and he always kind of says things you're not expecting. And we'd asked everyone Ronaldo's best goals, and a lot, maybe the UEFA Cup final came up. I'm not sure if that Cruzeiro goal came up. A lot of people spoke about the World Cup goals. For me, I think, you know, the toe punt against Turkey is right up there, even though the keeper just gets a little flick on it,
The
which is
telly
annoying,
bludger.
because I'd like it.
The
Yeah,
telly
I'd like it to go in.
the telly
Exactly.
bludger.
That's the toe. He toeied it. And yeah, but it's just such a beautiful goal, the turn, the spin. But Tim Vickery said his favorite Ronaldo goal was a penalty he scored. I was like, come on, Tim, for God's sake, man. But he had a whole story around, and ended up convincing me that it probably was the best goal, because he argued it so well. But no, for me, I think probably I think the seconds against Germany in the 2002 World Cup final is so hard to beat for so many reasons. And I think for me, as a filmmaker and a storyteller, and you know, that is just the moment where everything comes together in our film. And that beautiful first touch, he just cushions it and then curls it in. It's not the hardest goal he'll ever score, but he does it in a World Cup final, and it's the confirmation of the redemption. So I think as a storyteller, it's difficult to beat that one.
Awesome. Well, it's been, great to chat, Duncan. And really appreciate you sharing some of the stories today. And obviously, like the phenomenon, the Ronaldo story. Just let everyone know, where can they find your work? Where can they find the documentary and everything else that you've put together?
Yeah, I mean, that one's on the DAZN platform. The phenomenon on the DAZN platform in a number of territories. I know, obviously, we're not in charge of distribution, so it's difficult sometimes. Depending on, I know that you were struggling to find it in Australia, and I'm not certain what platform it is on in Australia, but yes, yeah, it's on the BBC in the UK, on BBC iPlayer. It's on Globo in Brazil. It's on Viaplay in certain countries in Europe, and it's on DAZN. Someone sent me a photo of the poster of the film from an aircraft the other day. So it's on Like, I don't know who they were flying with, but if you're lucky,
don't know who they were flying with or where they were going or what the destination, but somewhere up in the sky, it's showing in a plane.
If you're lucky, you might find it on your plane.
Yeah, magic. Awesome. Oh, thanks again, Duncan, for making the time.
Thank you, Frank.
Great. That was a great conversation with Duncan McMath, average to poor footballer turned filmmaker, as his Twitter profile says, and the phenomenon, the Ronaldo story. If you can get your hands on it and watch it, yeah, it's unbelievable. So thanks very much for listening. Please don't forget to rate, review, share, and follow the podcast. Every little bit helps. It's all much appreciated. Take care and enjoy your culture.